Three, two, one.
Independence and freedom are often mistaken to be the same thing. I think they're two different things. Independence is your ability to chase a dream, to do what you want, as long as you pay the right fees. Follow the right rules. Follow the right guidelines. Allow yourself to have oversight. Freedom is the ability to walk out the door, wake up in the morning, and do what you want, when you want, how you want to. And that's what this show is about. We're going to be talking about what we want to talk about, how we want to fucking talk about it. I'm going to bring you the truth. I'm going to bring you facts. I'm going to bring you data. Some of it may rub you the wrong way. Some of it may be something you don't even want to hear about. But you can best believe I'm going to tell you the fucking truth about it. I'm going to tell you like it is. This is your host, Christopher Scott Rutter.
Welcome to This Time in History, guys. I'm Matthew, and I am so pleased to be joined today by Christopher S. Rutter, the host, creator of the podcast, telling you how it is. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
I appreciate it, brother. How are you doing today?
I am doing so well, you know, as well as can be expected for a Monday.
You know, if I was any finer, I'd be frog fur, brother. So, you know, it is what it is. So, you know, just to welcome everybody in here. We are doing a borderline kind of a simulcast with this. We're both recording at the same time, Matt and I, with This Place in History, and Christopher S. Rutter is telling you how it is. You know, this week we've got a lot of different things that we're going to talk about. I'm very interested to see what Matt's interview style is going to be like. He's going to come at me with some things and try to get me to peel back some layers of the onion that most people don't normally get to hear on my show whenever it comes to personal revelations or anything like that. Most people who have followed me from day one, they know a lot of different things whenever it comes about my personal life and things like that. So we're going to see how that goes, and I'm going to bounce some stuff off of Matt and see how things kind of coincide between the two borders here that we share, with him being in Canada in the Ontario province and me being on the American side of it, and dealing with, you know, the usual things that everybody's used to hearing me talk about, dealing with politics, dealing with the conspiracies, dealing with the WHO, dealing with the New World Order, dealing with the WEF, dealing with all of these different things. And the really cool thing about it is that Matt is getting ready to start doing a lot of different interviews with a lot of different politicians who are up for the Canadian version of midterms, which right now we're in that process, but it's the choosing stage. Our midterms come up in November, so we're both kind of in a similar political kind of stratosphere going on right now. Here in the next 6 months, a lot of things can be chosen between American and Canadian politics here, so it's going to be very interesting to hear that side of things too. But the first part of the show here, this is all Matt's This Time in History, man. I turn it all over to you, brother. What do you want to talk about?
I just want to I'm such in awe. Like, I always do a little bit of preparation for my shows. I do a little bit, sometimes I don't, because sometimes I want to be surprised. I want to react as though I think my audience would react and ask the question that I think that they would ask. But I did take a look. You are, your stuff, it blows me away. So, I got to hear the story of how this all came to be. But why don't we start with where you were born, where you grew up, and how... how that led you into, I guess, wanting to be a podcast. Maybe no one wants to be a podcaster. Maybe it just happened. But whatever your story is, I'd love to hear it.
Okay, so maybe we'll just start with this and baby steps. Where I was born and raised. Born and raised in southern Indiana. Did most of my... the beginning and everything, my life was very chaotic. I was raised around bikers and strippers and hippies left over from the 60s and early 70s free love culture, okay? I'm 51, and so there's a long journey in front of us with all of this, but at the same time, whenever you're talking about that kind of upbringing here in southern Indiana, that most of my roots didn't actually start here until much later in age. I did a lot of farming and tobacco farming in Kentucky and Texas. I also traveled the road with my old man. He played with the Tower of Power Horns section with Fleetwood Mac in Chicago and Molly Hatchet and many other different groups. I didn't even go to school until I was 7 years old.
Wow.
So I was born very much a free spirit, and I was born very much very much a product of the 70s, okay? We'll just start with that.
The 70s is an interesting time. You know, I listened to my brother-in-law. He wasn't alive he was born in 78, but he talks about the 70s like he was there. So I can only imagine how it was for someone who actually was there.
Yeah, you know, through all of it, and remembering, you know, people coming back from Nam, and remembering the original gas crisis, which happened in 1977 under Jimmy Carter. I remember that. For some odd fucking reason, I've always had a very sponge-like absorption of the history that's going on around me, because my grandfather taught me a lot about history for World War II and pre-World War II, which is what has led to this very natural conversation that I'm able to have with all of these different political pieces going on around the world currently. Now, it's taken me almost 50 years to develop a voice for that. So, you know, I don't want to jump too far ahead. It's your interview, so you set up the premise here. But, you know, whenever you're dealing with somebody who toured around on my fifth birthday, my dad was playing in a small club with a group known as Molly Hatchet. And they play a song called Now You're Messing with the Son of a Bitch. They brought out a Huffy decorated in Harley Davidson stickers in the middle of that show, and I was in the bar that they were playing at. So you're dealing with somebody who grew up that kind of a way, but I also had a very natural attention to detail whenever it came to historic events that I'm able to remember and recall, not altruistically, but at the same time, I do have a little bit of there's a romanticism about everybody who remembers their youth. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I don't over romanticize those instances, because there was a lot of very defining moments that happened during those 10 years from, you know, 70 to 80, and then coming up in the 80s with Uncle Ronnie here with Ronald Reagan and the end of the Cold War. All of these things are very, very much embedded and etched in my head, because they were all so struck with steel. There were so many repeated messages that were beat into us in such a very specific way. I grew up in a very specific time where you were promised at least three or four things were going to happen to you. This is at least as a North American youth, okay? Maybe not in Canada, because you guys are a lot fucking nicer than we are. But at the end of the day, you know, the three or four things that I was promised without a doubt was going to fucking happen to me is that more than likely I'm going to catch AIDS. Probably I'll be kidnapped. Maybe there will be a tornado or a nuclear bomb that goes up that I can protect myself if I hide my head under the desk with a book over my head. And you'll probably end up dying being addicted of drugs. These are the four messages that I received over and over and over and over. A message of propaganda during the 80s. That's what it was like growing up here in the United States. Now, everybody romanticizes it, like Knight Rider and fucking Miami Vice and all this shit. But all of the behind-the-scenes stuff was very scary. And I paid attention to the very scary shit.
Wow. For me personally, I didn't start paying attention to politics until maybe closer, I'd say the mid-90s, like, well, 97.
Okay.
That's when I used to think that Bill Clinton was the shit. He was the best.
Well, he played saxophone, and he smoked weed, he didn't inhale, and at that point in time, we all knew that he got a blowjob under the Oval Office desk. You know, so yeah, of course he's the shit at that point in time. But whenever you look at things from a historical point of view, going into all of that, the death of hair bands, the transformation of MTV from heavy metal and actual rock and roll, then grunge, and then it was Jersey Wars, and rap and everything. And it was like, remember whenever they used to actually play music, and now it's Pregnant at 16 or whatever the fuck. All of that shit started in the 90s.
I know, but I'm all gonna be partial to the 90s. It's like what you were saying before, you romanticize your youth.
Yeah.
For me, my youth was the 90s.
I get it. Yeah, and exactly. So that's why everybody brings these two different points of view to these, these kinds of discussions. Whenever I hit on Bill Clinton, the reason I hit on him, of course, people of your age are going to remember, he played the saxophone, he smoked weed, he got a blowjob. Fuck, he must be fucking cool. What I remember is that he inherited the White House with a majority in the Democratic Senate and House, and then lost it during his midterm, and almost lost his reelection because he was trying to be impeached, or they were trying to impeach him. He lost that much control of the House and Congress and Senate here in the United States, where his second term was very, very much on the wire. That was whenever Ross Perot came in. And we were all talking about, like, hey, man, this third party idea, this is really fucking cool. Like, you don't have to be a Republican. You don't have to be a Democrat. There's this third guy. There's this third idea who kind of straddles everything that both of the other guys are saying, but he's not old school politician. And that was the beginning of the clean out the swamp and term limits ideas, which everybody brought up whenever Trump was president. But it was brought up originally whenever Bill Clinton got elected into office. And all of us acted like we fucking forgot about it. That's the scary part that I remember versus the romanticized version that you remember.
Right. So I want to get into more of this. I got to be honest with you, I love politics. It's one of my favorite topics, and nobody likes to talk about it, especially here in Canada. Nobody wants to talk about politics. It's like one of those taboo things. You don't talk about religion, you don't talk about politics. So I want to get into that, but I just want to hear, for my listeners' sake, how you came up with the podcast and how it got started before we move on.
Okay, so where we left off and where the podcast started. Probably 10 or 12 years ago, me and my best friend, Joe Shriver, who's the original co-creator of the What's Your F and Binge Network, we would sit around our table and just be fucking blasted out of our fucking minds, be higher than fuck, and be like, this would be fucking gold if we were allowed to be on the radio. And then through the creation of technology and it catching up here in southern Indiana, which ended up being many years later, about circa 2019, before COVID, I was like, bro, here's our way to be able to do us on the microphone. We don't need a radio station. We can talk however the fuck we want about whatever the fuck we want and say whatever and just be totally off the cuff. We don't have to be scripted or rehearsed. Just drop a topic in the middle of the table. This year's Oscar nominations, our favorite Oscar nominee, our favorite TV series. That's what we gravitated towards at the beginning, which is the creation of the What's Your Effin' Binge Network. What we originally did was that we would have celebrity guests on and people from all walks of life as well, but also fellow podcasters. So you're dealing with the list of personalities from A to Z, and we would have them come on our show, and we would not let them tell us what their favorite show they're currently binge watching is. And so we would go through a series of questions of basic reporting skills of who, what, where, when, and why, and guess what show it is they're currently binge watching was. The original premise of the show, which would have been great if we would have had some sort of funding or backing, so that way neither one of us would have to work, so we would be able to actually allot all the time needed to this. We did not actually look at fast forward 3 months from now, we've interviewed 12 people, and they've given us 12 different TV series that have anywhere from 3 to 20 seasons to them. We didn't think that far ahead. We just thought it was a cool idea because we know so much about TVs and movies. So we ended up having people bring... Then they... Fast forward at about 20 episodes of this. We're very good. We're able to guess on a rate of about 8 out of 10 people. We're able to guess what their series was without needing hints or extra questions or whatever the fuck it was. Between me and Joe, we're able to figure it out. Even if we haven't watched this series, we've read enough liner notes on TV series to be able to guess pretty much what it is that you're fucking talking about. And, you know, whenever we ask who, what, when, where, and why, then we're able to give return questions. It's basically like point counterpoint on an interview. And we were able to nail down a large amount of people's TV series they were watching. Everything from Hoarders to, fuck, man, you fucking name it. We had so many obscure shows brought to our show because people brought it as a challenge to stump us. Like, all of a sudden, it's like BoJack Horseman. Like, we're supposed to fucking know that? Or Infinity Train? We're supposed to fucking know that? And it got to the point where on one episode, some fucking asshole, I'm not going to say any names or anything like that, but him and his wife were a writing team who did romantic novels, and the TV series that he brought to us was Virgin River. And I was like, how in the fuck do you expect two guys who are in their mid to late 40s, one of them used to be a fucking biker and a strip club fucking bouncer, the other one is fucking used to cook meth in the fucking desert of fucking Arizona, how do you fucking expect us to come up with this as an answer? This is ridiculous. So we dropped that whole shtick. It was great at the beginning, but as our publicist talked it up, it became a challenge for the guest to come on and bring something so obscure we would never be able to guess it, so that way they could look smart.
Before you go on, can I give you mine for free?
All right, bring it.
Here's the trade-off. You can't make fun of me.
Okay.
I'm watching Little House on the Prairie.
Oh, dude, shit. You're talking about one of the biggest smoke shows of the 70s and 80s as the daughter who grew up to be the smoke show redhead. Okay, that is very ingrained in anybody my age's DNA, okay? Now, would I be able to get there in 5 questions or less? Maybe, because, you know, the way we would lead in is, okay, is this a time period piece? And then, of course, you would have to say yes. Okay. Is this set in a very specific state, or is this set in an area? Or, you know, like, what's the demographic? Is this based around a certain family? You would have to say yes, it's in a certain state. You would have to say yes, it's around a certain family. Now we're getting there. I might be able to get to that in 6 questions or less. But, yeah, Little House on the Prairie, man, that's fucking Americana at its finest.
It was one of my late mother's favorite, if not her favorite TV show. It was one of them.
I guarantee it. Anybody who grew up, if she was in her 50s, 40s or 50s by the 70s and 80s, then, yeah, she grew up with that show. Even if she was only in her 40s by the end of the 80s, she grew up with that TV series with Michael Landon and everybody else. And that was a CBS staple for... fuck, man. I want to say almost 16 years. At that point in time, maybe the second longest running continuous TV series period piece besides MASH.
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Yeah, whenever you're talking about that kind of rarefied air, okay? And for anybody who's young out there and you're like, fucking MASH, Little House on the Prairie, that's fucking stupid. Okay, well, the longest running series you have right now is Pregnant in 16, homie. Chill out, okay? We're talking about, like, real writing and real actors. Anyways, bro, go ahead.
So, how did you make the switch from this format to your current format?
Life. The biggest thing was, okay, the recording schedule wasn't that out of hand. Okay, having guests come on. But the way Joe and I did it was we interviewed the guest, guessed their show, or didn't. You know, like I said, we had about a 7 or 8 out of 10 success rate. Then we would watch the series and come back with its rating on the second half of the show. So we would do a 2-hour show. The first half with the live recording of the guest, the second half, a week later, 3 weeks later, 6 weeks later, of watching the entire goddamn TV series. So we came up with the hashtag, and you can plug this in on Twitter right now. It still comes up, even though we haven't done a actual show of What's Your Effing Binge for almost a year and a half or 2 years. You could still plug in hashtag dumpster juice, and it will bring you to my show. For anybody who brought us a show that we thought was absolute fucking filth. And if not, if we didn't consider it absolute filth, we'd rate it on a scale of 1 to 10. So the shows that garnered the title of dumpster juice was Riverdale, Virgin River, Infinity Train, BoJack Horseman, and I want to say there was maybe another one. But anyways, we had so many interviews that we came up with 4 shows that were just absolute fucking filth and trashed us. And we would lead off every conversation with, okay, keep in mind, if this is the show you want us to guess, keep in mind, our top 10 includes Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, Mayans, what was the other one? Peaky Blinders, Sons of Anarchy, and you know, shows along those lines. Okay, you're dealing with 2 like 40, almost 50-year-old dudes, and these are our top 10. So if this is the show you're bringing us, how do you think we're going to rate this show? And we had somebody, the last show that we did was the guy who brought Virgin River to us. I'm not going to mention his name. He's a voice actor. He does like this Hallmark voiceover work bullshit. And I was like, this motherfucker is so cuckolded by his fucking wife that this is the show he brings to us to actually have to waste our time on. This motherfucker can't even control his own remote control. Like, I trashed him. I was like, this is enough. It was horrible. Okay, like, that's like going into Howard Stern territory or whatever the case is. But, like, I was just like, this is fucking crazy. Well, anyways, Joe at that point in time, his wife and him had tried for many, many years. And she ended up being 38 and him 41 and them giving birth to a very lovely little girl. And his whole heart, his whole purpose, and his whole life developed into caring for Jelly Bean is what I call her, okay? So, you know, life took its path on that. So then I was left to... Not that I can't rely on Joe to show up on the shows that we were setting, but, you know, like if you got a baby crying in the fucking background and that you're a first-time dad at 40, you know, like at 40, I'd already been through a couple kids. Like, it's like, fucking let the kid cry. Give it a bottle. Whatever. No, that's not, you know, that's not the way Joe and Sarah are wired, okay? It's just the way it is. And I love them for that. They have become so much more and better parents and a better father and mother than anything I could give an example of. So I will not take anything from that. So we had to reach a mutual agreement. I was like, when you can and when you will, we will do a show and we will do it under the What's Your Effing Binge banner. But in the meantime, I have to do this. And the impetus to all of this was a very dramatic change in my life that I won't discuss any details of, but I lost a wife. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay, man. It is what it is. Like, 24 months ago, I would have fucking hung up on you right now for saying that. Which it is not a good thing or a bad thing, okay? You didn't do anything wrong. I'm just saying, like, that's where I was because of that incident, okay? Mm-hmm. So, I went through a very horrible downward spiral. Tried to recover in whatever different ways. I lived homelessly in a truck. Lived in camping and hunting grounds in middle Kentucky. Lived by a campfire and with a bow and arrow, strung up a couple fucking does and bucks, and made it through the next 4 or 5 months. It got warm, and I came out of it. And somewhat, I don't know, very fractured. Not fragile by any shake of the fucking stick. That's not going to be what anybody tries to apply as a definition to me. I'm not fragile by any shape of the mean. I used to fight for a living whenever UFC was first starting as tournament fighting. Here in North America, we had another promotion that was competing for fighters and competing for audience called Hook and Shoot Fighting. I fought in that. I fought in 23 professional fights. I trained in wrestling. I went through Dutch Mantel's wrestling school. Came out, found out that I was not a good hand or a good worker. I was too quick to temper and too quick to throw some potatoes and throw some real fucking punches when it was not needed. I did not have the actual patience I thought I did going into it. So the wrestling career was quickly thrown out the window. One of my best friends who actually ran the promotion here in Southern Indiana, along with, do you know Jim Cornette? Do you know that name?
I'm a big fan, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
I was listening to one of his episodes earlier today while I was working, actually.
Was it the Jim Cornette on Ric Flair's last wrestling match?
No. I listened to his
drive through. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So he's covered so many subjects, but the most recent one that I saw was Jimmy Cornette talking about, and it was, I think it was on the drive through or maybe the Jim Cornette Experience. I don't know which one. He has two different channels on YouTube, but he was talking about Ric Flair's last match. And it's like, fuck, man. Like, I came up and I wrestled in the same Coliseum that Jerry Lawler wrestled in and fucking was there whenever the Fabulous Ones and whenever Jerry Lawler and Austin Idol fucking took the belts off the Road Warriors and all of that fucking shit here in Southern Indiana. That's like part of the subculture of where I grew up in, okay? So I thought I wanted to be a wrestler. And so I ended up going through Dutch Mantel school. I trained with Dutch Mantel, trained a little bit with Bill Dundee and Handsome Jimmy Valiant.
You know how fucking jealous I am of you right now?
Don't be, because it's fucking horrible, all right? Here's the big deal. Back then, in the early 90s, whenever you're dealing with all of these big names and their schools, what they generally will do is abuse you. They will rough you up. They will abuse you. They will stretch you. They will fucking hammer you down without teaching you how to take bumps. Then they will teach you how to run ropes. That's the way wrestling schools 30 years ago operated. They weeded all of the weak out of the chaff, okay? So, because I grew up with Eric Akers, whose father controlled the Evansville Coliseum, which every Wednesday night, Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee, Jimmy Valiant, Austin Idol, all of these guys, everybody you've ever fucking heard of from the early 90s, they all came through here. I grew up being able to run around in the locker room with all these guys. So obviously the ideal situation was me become a wrestler. The problem was I didn't have the actual temperament to work a match. And Eric soon invested into the Hook and Shoot Fighting program. And he was like, bro, it's going to take a long time to get you to actually work a good fucking match with anybody who's a headliner of a card. Why don't we just have you fight? And I was like, sure, what the fuck ever, when the fuck ever. And that's the kind of guy I was in my mid-20s. It's not good, it's not cool, it's not bad, it is what it is, okay? you're dealing with, you know, somebody who was raised by bikers and, you know, all of this shit. And so, you know, to be able to throw hands was above and beyond everything, okay? The ability to take a punch and throw a punch. So when I worked matches, which I worked matches with Brian Christopher and Too Sexy, Bill Dundee's son, and a lot of different people here in the area. I even worked in Ohio Valley Wrestling with Big Show, Paul Wright at that time, he was actually called. Worked a few cards with those people, tag team matches primarily, and I was just not a good hand. If anybody got snug or too tight with me, I was throwing taters, okay? It's just the way it was. So it took about, I don't know, less than 20 matches. And Eric was like, you're not a good guy in the locker room, bro. You get off the rails way too fucking soon. You're not, everybody knows you're just not there right, head-wise. So he put me in Hook and Shoot Promotions, and I traveled from Southern Indiana to Clemson, South Carolina, to Birmingham, Alabama. I went to Jacksonville, Florida. Altogether, I wrestled, I fought, and participated in 24 pro fights. In the meantime, behind the curtains, I also participated in about, I don't want to lie, because Eric has since passed away, so I don't have anybody to actually check me on this recollection here, but I think it was either 17 or 18 just prize bouts that were basically fight club fights, okay? And that's the way it was in the 90s, okay? Nobody, don't take any aspersions to this. This is, you can look this up. It's historic fact. It is what it is. There's even fight videos of Christopher S. Michaels, which was my wrestling name. But it's the video is so goddamn bad, you can't even fucking tell it's me. But at the same time, these bare knuckle fights that were happening in the mid-90s, late 90s, before the UFC became what it truly became. Okay? That's the simplest way for me to explain all of that. From the early to the late 90s, I bounced in all the strip clubs. Here in Mid-America, I worked everywhere from Deja Vu in Indianapolis to Louisville, in Owensboro, Kentucky, to Evansville, Indiana, and St. Louis, and the Silver Saddle, and the Roxy, and all these other clubs. I was a bouncer there, rode everywhere. You know, it is what it is. And whenever I showed up in town, it was basically just to work a couple of weekends at the strip club, get some money under my belt, so that way I could bet on myself to fight in these non-sanctioned matches.
Wow, that's quite a story. I'm still jealous.
it's a cool story, man. It really is, as far as, like, you know, being able to train with Dutch and fucking Handsome Jimmy Valiant. And the most I took from him is maybe, like, six or seven of his, like, super famous hip tosses. He had this very cool way of digging deep and bringing you over very high. It was almost like a high spot back in the day. This very cool high spot hip toss. Very simple move. You're taking a simple bump. You're just getting over in the air. And he trained us on how to do that. Training with Bill Dundee on working off the second rope, not the top rope. Second rope. Power clotheslines, working the ropes on a two or three rope exchange, cross, you know, whenever you're doing the crossfire, working those ways, dropping, jumping up, doing a high jump. It was very cool. Very cool. And whenever you're in there at the ring with somebody who you've grown up watching, obviously you're going to do whatever the fuck they tell you. And then whenever they put you in the ring with an unannounced finish, things get kind of fucking weird, which that was also at the time of the ECW, okay? So the extreme matches going off the record and out of hand, that was regular practice. I was in matches with, I was in two matches with Sandman and one match with Sabu, three matches with Brian Christopher, and couple matches in a handicap. I was in one handicap match with Paul Wright, and then in a tag team match against him with Brian Christopher. So, you know, it is what it is, and I just was not a good hand. I did not have the right temperament that I thought growing up. You know, so many of these pro wrestling stars, they're like, you know, I watched it and I loved it and I did everything to absorb it. My biggest thing was at that time getting in with all of these mid-promotional guys, these mid-card guys at the high level. You know, they throw punches, y'all. Okay, don't get it twisted. They hit. And if somebody connected a tater with me, we're getting in. And at that point in time, I'm training Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu. And so, okay, all right, let's fucking get down. And that's whenever Eric was like, you need to be in hook and shoot. You don't have the right temperament for that. So my wrestling career was very short-lived, and my fight career was a lot longer than it probably should have been. But it was a very eventful and fun thing, you know?
Like I said, that's an amazing story. And so now you have this podcast, and I love the fact that you say what the fuck you want. You're very direct. You're very blunt. And people hear that, and they just resonate with that approach.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And the whole fight game and all of that stuff is actually something that I leave completely out of the Christopher S. Rutter Telling You Like It Is podcast. It has nothing to do with any of it. The only difference is, and I don't know, maybe this is the persona or something that I subconsciously created. Like, if I was able to put this persona or put this mic work together at that point in time was somebody who would shoot, who would stretch people, who would fucking get in the corner and fucking do dirty work. If I was able to put this together with what that was now, maybe it would be a totally different experience. But back in those days, it was a very much dog-eat-dog world. And you either had the favor of the promoter or you did not. And whenever it came to the finish, if it was an unplanned finish, the ref would come in and slide in and tell you, okay, this is three count or not, okay? And if you weren't in favor, like you were always getting not the three count, and then you would end up pissed with somebody who threw in my, what it ended up being later is somebody who, they're trying to throw taters and your punches are fucking water, bro. That's, and I'm never going to mention any names, okay? Never will. Because those guys went on to play in the WWE and I did not. But your punches are fucking water. So, it is what it is. So, I ended up doing something that, I don't know if it benefits you or whatever the case is, but I ended up doing something that ended up being a lot longer. It lasted quite a few years. I was able to bounce in strip clubs and do all this shit with escort services and everything. All these cool things that a lot of guys think are very cool stories and a lot of really cool fringe benefits attached to it. Which, you know, once or twice a week, maybe that's the case, but the rest of the time, it's a goddamn nightmare to just throw somebody over your shoulder and get the fuck out of the hotel. That's kind of the way that shit fucking worked back in those days, whenever things were not regulated and there was no big dog promotion at that point in time.
And now if you wanted to, I guess, segue, oh shit, that's a bad transition, but anyway, like I said in the beginning, I'm very eager to talk about politics, so I don't know if you want me to start from the Canadian side of things, and I don't know how much you know about how Canadian politics works, but I'll fill in the blanks for if you like.
Okay, all right. So what we're getting ready to go into is the primaries for the midterms. The primaries basically allow you to select the people who are going to run this November against the elected official. This is the opponent of the incumbent, is what's happening right now. Everybody gets to select that opponent of the person who is actually elected in office. And this is our chance to vote them out or keep them in. Okay? How similar is that to what you guys are going through in Ontario?
Okay, so in Canada, there's three levels of government in Canada. We have federal, we have provincial, which for you guys is like state government, and right. Then we have municipal. So every 4 years.
Okay, for the listeners' sake on this, how does Ontario, Canada translate to that three-layer discussion?
Okay, so specifically in Ontario, this year we're going to the polls twice, once for provincial and once for municipal. So for provincial, we have three main parties. And each party has a leader. So, for argument's sake, if Party A gets the most votes, they'll get the most seats, even if they don't have a majority. And the leader of the party becomes the premier, which for you guys would be like the governor.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. At what level is it similar to the governor of the state? Like, I live in Indiana. And we have a governor. And then within Indiana, the capital of Indiana is Indianapolis, and they have a mayor.
Yes.
Okay.
And so I can't speak for the rest of the provinces, but in Ontario, all of Ontario in October of this year, we're going for our municipal election. The municipal election will elect a mayor, city council, and school trustees.
Okay.
And that happens every 4 years. Now, it never goes to where you have all three elections in 1 year. That rarely ever happens.
That's what we call the midterms, because you have the national elections and then the state and local Senate and House elections, which I'm guessing is the premier of each province. That's basically like your state representative and then your Senate. And within each state, depending on the population, you can have anywhere from 2 to 5 House representatives, but each state can only have 2 senators and only 1 governor. And there's 50 states in the United States, right? So this is where things become convoluted, and I think it's a very defining thing between our two countries, because you guys also have a parliament, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And the parliament is made up of who?
We have the House of Commons, which is where the federal government meets. That's in Ottawa. And then we have, for Ontario specifically, we have what's called Parliament, and that's here in Toronto.
So for Americans, Ontario would be 1 congressional district for us, and Winnipeg would be another, Montreal would be another, Vancouver would be another. But those are totally different countries within you guys, right? Like, Vancouver has shit to do with Ontario.
So BC, like how Ontario has a premier, BC also has a premier.
Okay. So what is Trudeau?
Trudeau is the prime minister.
So he's the prime minister, then you have premier.
Yeah, so the prime minister is the basically the president.
Right.
And the premiers of each province are like the governors of each state.
But you guys only have, what is it, 5 provinces or 6?
We have 10 provinces and like 3 territories, and each one has a premier.
Okay, so you guys have 10 to 13 premiers that answer up to the prime minister, which is Trudeau. Or do they rule individually?
I don't know if I would put it that way, because each province province has their own, I guess, budget and their own powers. But ultimately, yeah,
Okay, let me simplify it for at least my listeners on this part. Okay, let's say you have the West Coast, the Southwest, the North, the Mid-Central states, you have the Southeast, and then you have the Northeast. The way our country is geopolitically separated is about five or six different areas. And the Northeast is from Massachusetts to New Jersey. The Southeast is from North Carolina to Florida. The South is from Georgia over to Mississippi. The Southwest is Texas and Arizona and New Mexico. And then you have the Far West, which is Wyoming, Montana, and California.
Okay.
That would be the way that our country is geopolitically, not geopolitically, because that's not the right term for this conversation, but that is the way our country is almost segregated based on voting values and the way that we look at the difference between the two main parties, either the right or the left, right? So does it translate that way into Canada with those? Is that the way it's kind of split up?
No. So how it works is we still go by total votes.
Amongst all provinces or just the one?
Yeah. When there's a federal election, it's total votes.
That's for the prime minister, right?
I'm sorry?
That's for the prime minister, right?
Yeah. But it works the same way. For every level, every election, whether it doesn't matter if it's municipal, provincial, or federal, it's total votes.
Gotcha.
They've been talking about changing that, but they haven't done that yet.
Okay, in America, we have what's called the Electoral College. Have you heard of this?
Yes.
Okay, so in the Electoral College, California, because they have 87 million people total, they're worth 13 electoral college votes. Whereas Mississippi, because they only have 4 million people, they're only worth 2 electoral votes. Does it kind of work this way from province to province, or is every vote count?
Every vote counts.
Gotcha. Okay.
The problem is that people are not voting enough.
Well, we've seen that except for this is a very weird stat here in North America, including you guys, is that from the time period of 1972 to 1996, which for us is everything from Nixon to Clinton, okay? You got Nixon, you got Carter, you have Reagan, you have the first Bush, and then you have two terms of Clinton. Each electoral process resulted in less and less votes. And then it kind of leveled out with the Bush two terms, and then once we brought in Obama, the votes went up, and then once we brought in Clinton, Hillary versus Trump, the votes went even higher. All of a sudden, we had this huge vote count. But for about 50 years, it leveled and kind of tapered off. Is that what you guys saw too?
I got to be honest with you, I don't really keep track of the total number of votes. I do know that not enough people vote. I did notice that there was an uptick the very first time that Justin Trudeau ran for prime minister, because people thought he was the second coming of Jesus Christ, and I'm not kidding you.
Okay, so that's a very interesting statement from a Canadian. Okay, all right. So let me... So this is where we're getting into a simulcast deal, okay? All right, so Trudeau, the first time he ran for election was give or take 10 years ago, right?
I think it was 2015.
Okay, 7 years ago. All right, cool. All right. When he first came in, he came in as very anti-partisan. He came in also as very, what the masses tell us to do is what we are going to do. And then since then, he has turned into this dictator, tyrannical set. How much were you guys aware of the fact that he graduated from the Young Leaders Development Group of the World Economic Forum as led by Klaus Schwab?
I actually didn't know that. I knew frighteningly little about this guy other than the fact that I knew who his father was and I knew he came from money.
And Trudeau's father was the first person who enacted the Emergencies Act, which basically declared martial law.
Yes.
Okay. Now, so how aware of you of that during his first term versus his last term? How much more politically aware or globally aware have you all become over the past 7 years?
What do you mean by globally? Like, are you talking about specifically what he's done?
I'm talking about the fact that you didn't even realize that his father enacted the original martial law during World War II, and then come to find out, here he is, this global communist, enacting tyrannical acts. He's basically labeling truckers for freedom as Nazis. What was the difference in that learning curve?
I think that nothing that he does surprises me, but it's only gotten worse. I mean, that the whole trucker thing, that was a huge point. But he had already fallen off the rails before that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different instances you could bring up for that, and I'll let you do that because you have to be more of an expert than I do. I'm only speaking from a proliferary kind of point of view on him.
But, you know, we're talking about a guy who is a self-proclaimed feminist, and that's bullshit. We're talking about a guy
Go ahead. You there?
Yeah. So what I was saying was, he wants to enforce that everyone has to follow these high set of rules, specifically leaders and politicians. For example, there was a member of the government within his own party that was accused of sexual harassment. Well, he fired his ass and got rid of him. And then come to find a little while later, a woman accused him of groping her, back before he became a politician. But he decided to just ignore that, and he didn't have to step down. He didn't have to step aside. He didn't have to really even address it. I think he maybe said a few words, but that was it.
That lady that we're talking about, who was a member of the parliament, right? Was that the first instance you saw of the rules for thee do not apply to me?
Yes. No, the woman was actually a reporter, but yes, that it was the first time. And then there was the whole, I don't know if you heard about the whole SNC-Lavalin scandal, where he went to one of the government, like an MP, which is a member of parliament, on his team.
That's a minister or parliamentary or whatever the fuck they call it?
Went to her and said that she was in charge of the federal court system, and he's like, don't bring charges against these guys, do as I say. And she ended up exposing him, and it was a whole big thing. And
he said she said thing, or do you guys have a version of Freedom of Information Act where you're able to actually bring forth documents of recorded conversations to present as evidence.
We do have the Freedom of Information Act, but I don't know how deep that goes, and I don't know what it would include and not include. Probably wouldn't include private conversations, I'm thinking.
Okay, so our Freedom of Information Act, of anybody who is of an appointed position, okay, let's just take, this is a, I don't want to get into this conversation yet because I know this is coming up later, but let's just say that you have a governor, which for us is the leader of a state like Michigan or a province within Ontario. Is that the way that works?
No, Ontario is the province, but yes.
Okay, all right. So there are different districts within Ontario, the province, right? And each one of them has their own governor or gubernatorial representation. It's just called a different name. What do you guys call that?
In Ontario has a mayor.
Okay, all right. So you guys call it a mayor, we call it a governor. Whatever, same difference at the end of the day, whenever you're dealing with the electoral process, just different names. Your guys' names of things are more attached to what France and England has done, right? That's where the names of all of this kind of comes from and translates from. Within French Canada, right?
Yeah, I would say for the most part.
Okay, all right. And not to oversimplify it, I don't want to get into like a whole historical conversation on it. But let's just say, for example, that there is a governor who we had an uncovered plot that she was going to be kidnapped. And that plot was uncovered. And then come to find out, the people who were brought up on charges were actually led and taught and funded and instructed by FBI agents. How's that sound for a mind blower, okay? That actually happened with the governor of Michigan. And it's being attached to the January 6th, what they now call the J6 invasion. Yeah, and this is a very fucked up thing. And this is something that's being very underplayed by the press. And that's something that I want to bring up next with how your all's press plays with the politicians and the politics and how they actually portray that to the citizens. Because one of the big things that I am a big proponent of is you cannot believe a single word that is given to you by the paid-for corporate media press, which includes CNN, which includes Fox. It's both sides of the aisle. The Biden administration in 2020 gave $1 billion to CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, NBC, and ABC, and Fox to not spread any quote-unquote disinformation about the vaccination. You were not allowed to speak badly of it if you took that payment. All right, everybody, that's going to conclude this week's part one of this episode. We have two other more parts coming out. This is going to come out on Thursday, May the 19th. The next part will be out this Saturday. The following and last part of dealing with Matt King and this time in history will be out on Monday, May the 21st. So till next time, don't get any on you. And don't forget your squeezy. Everybody, that concludes part one of this week's episode. It's coming out on Thursday, May the 19th. So if you're hearing it, it came out this morning. Next episode comes out Saturday. Until next time, don't get any on you.
And don't forget to squeeze me.